The process can be viewed from level 2. A balcony was built for distinguished guests, nicknamed Golda's Balcony. And that's the control room as shot by Vananu. Only 150 employees are authorised to enter it. Visits are limited to the Prime Minister, the Ministry of Military Affairs, and a small group of confidants. Equipped with a hidden camera, Vananu walked about Institute No. 2 and took pictures of the different sections. Not only plutonium is produced here. At level number 4, Vananu revealed the production of tritium used in the production of thermonuclear bombs, which are more powerful than ordinary atomic bombs. Two other essential materials for the bomb are produced here, lithium and deuterium. All these ingredients are taken to level 5, to unit MD2, the metal department, where they are assembled into a bomb. One level down is a recreation room where Vananu shot what experts identified as a model of an Israeli thermonuclear bomb. 10 times more powerful than the bomb dropped on Hiroshima. Experts that analysed Vananu's testimony determined that by the 80s, Israel had produced 100 to 200 atomic bombs. This ranks Israel as the 6th or even 5th nuclear power in the world. From Amman, we travel to southern Jordan. High cancer rates were recorded in all the southern Jordanian governorates, which confirms the possible direction of nuclear dust that might be leaking from Dimona. Tips we received claim that in Jordan there are hundreds of cases of cancer and other diseases, all of them in the regions near the border with Israel. From Talifar to Dimona, it is about 30 kilometers, and winds or water knows no borders. In almost every house in this region, we can find the same story, diseases and death. Dimona is a word that everybody knows around here. But in Jordan, like in Israel, Dimona and its deadly consequences are a taboo. Saleh is a tour guide and an activist. For years, he is trying to uncover what is happening to the people around the Tafila region. Our next stop is in Tafila. Here, the average manifestation of cancer is higher than the other Jordanian governorates and surrounding Arab countries. Going to visit the governor's office, where we are going to meet the mayor and the governor of the region. It's a surprise what we are going to hear. People around Tafila region are dying from cancer in high numbers. The doctors link the cases to Dimona contamination. But officially, nobody can say it, not even the ones that are dying. Dana is an amazing natural treasure in Jordan, too close to Dimona. Barsem Saudi was born here, in this land, a step away from Dimona nuclear plant. He knows that his people are dying silently and wants answers that never come. Is Dimona nuclear plant poisoning its Arab neighbours? While we were filming with Bassam Saudi, some guards at the Dana Natural Reserve approach us. They want to break their silence. they also have a story to tell about how Dimona is killing their families. We are back in Palestine to visit some villages south of Al-Khalil, very close to the Negev Desert and Dimona. Here, the cancer rates are growing in alarming numbers. The causes are not more than rumours. Nuclear radioactive leakage from Dimona and nuclear waste dumps in the area, or even both. We try to find a clear answer to these rumours in Berlin with Xantha Hall.
200 cubic metres a year were produced in Dimona, and it's been running for more than 40 years. We can estimate about 8,000 cubic metres of waste, radioactive waste, have been, as the bottom line, have been produced. And to try and imagine what that is, it's maybe, in a picture, 50,000 standard barrels of oil would be about 8,000 cubic metres. We also don't know where they bury this waste. They say that it's not far from the reactor, and the main problem that we're looking at here is what state are these stainless steel containers in? Are they corroded? Will they be leaking? Are they seeping into the ground, into the water sources? Are we seeing pollution of the environment, and therefore of people's health? I mean, I don't know exactly the geography of the area, but there it's chalk, and I imagine that the whole area is probably also chalk, and that is not a good area to be deposing any kind of waste. And they saw that with this toxic waste dump, because there was leakages and serious health problems were discovered. So I would imagine that it would be similar in the area around Dimona, because it's not far away. And also whether it gets into the water or not, because once it gets into the water, then it transports much further into other areas and people can drink it that are quite far away. So then we're talking about basically that there would be cancers later on or leukemia, and in particularly the children would be badly affected, because children and especially women are more susceptible to radiation. The effects on them are much greater than grown men, for instance. I would say that those are the ones that we have found, definitely in the studies that have been done around nuclear installations in Germany, that the main problem was childhood cancer. And in the areas surrounding plutonium reprocessing plants like Sellafield, in the UK, the main problem was leukemia.
The radioactivity has a tremendous power that can penetrate the human gene, affecting generation after generation. Jamal is a Palestinian policeman. He was arrested after the Second Intifada and spent 13 years in jail. Now he is free, but living a new hell. His daughter has cancer. At the age of 9, she was diagnosed with leukemia. Nothing in the medical report says this Palestinian girl is a direct victim of Dimona. But she comes from an area that counts 70% of cancer cases among the Palestinian population. Israel is probably the 6th or even 5th nuclear power in the world. While others should open the doors of their nuclear programs for inspections, Israel is a special case, producing nuclear weapons since the 60s without any control. Meanwhile, the cancer cases and other diseases are spreading across Israel, Palestine, and neighboring Arab countries. The victims die without knowing what or who is killing them.
Well, even if Dimona's deadly weapons of mass destruction are never used, still, the reactor has been silently killing masses of defenseless citizens throughout the decades, and it continues doing so. By continuing to maintain and operate the Dimona reactor, Israel is committing a crime against humanity that will be added to the atrocities that is perpetrated throughout its history. And that's it for this week, everyone. Until another episode of Aperture, it's goodbye.
Your option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
EU countries have cut gas consumption. According to the Gas Exporting Countries Forum, pipeline imports by the EU were down 20% in June in annual terms. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. RT noted, natural gas consumption by EU members has been falling, with imports of pipe fuel totaling 11.6 billion cubic meters BCM in June, a 20% year-on-year decrease. The Gas Exporting Countries Forum, GECF, has said in its monthly report. The publication released recently showed that in the first half of 2023, consumption of gas by the 27-member union dropped by 10% in annual terms, amounting to 178 BCM. Overall, pipeline gas deliveries to the EU plummeted by 34% to 76.7 BCM as a result of reduced imports from Russia and Norway. This decline was primarily due to the growing wind and solar energy output, which led to a decrease in the reliance on gas for electricity generation. In addition, the ongoing implementation of the EU regulation promoting a voluntary 15% reduction in gas demand from 1 April 2023 to 31 March 2024 impacted the gas consumption in the EU, the GECF stated. According to the report, industrial sector demand has not fully recovered compared to last year, despite gas prices recently falling. Gas-based electricity production within the EU was down by 17% year-on-year, while total electricity production decreased by 7%, reaching 182 terawatt hours. Additionally, there was a significant decrease of 39% in electricity generation from coal. The EU previously covered about two-fifths of its gas needs through Russian energy imports. Last year, member states agreed to voluntarily reduce gas consumption by 15% from August 2022 until March 2023. The agreement has been extended for another 12 months. However, according to the European Environmental Bureau, only 14 out of 27 EU nations have adopted compulsory measures to slash energy consumption. Five of the 14 of the European countries, including Germany, France, Italy, Spain, and Portugal, reportedly made up 60% of the fall in demand, while Bulgaria, Latvia, and Romania were the only member states that have not implemented any energy-saving regulations. This was partially attributed to already low gas demand in these countries. Energy experts have cited the mild winter of 2022 as helping EU members to consume less energy, while high prices resulted in energy-intensive industries scaling back production. Meanwhile, Financial Times reported, in March, EU countries agreed to extend the 15% demand reduction target for another year, even though energy-saving efforts have not been felt evenly across the bloc. A report published recently by the European Environmental Bureau found that only 14 of the 27 EU countries had introduced compulsory measures to cut energy consumption, and five of these, including Germany, France, Italy, Spain, and Portugal, made up 60% of the fall in demand. The report said the most robust measures on gas savings have been implemented in countries that import large quantities of Russian gas, such as Italy and Germany. Russian imports previously made up about two-fifths of the bloc's gas, but have been steadily cut by Moscow in the run-up to and after last year's Russia-Ukraine crisis in an attempt to raise prices and squeeze the EU's energy supplies. Preliminary data from the Commission shows that in March, EU imports of Russian gas were 74% lower than they were in March 2021, the document said. Overall, annual gas supplies from Russia fell about 150.2 BCM in 2021 to 74.4 BCM in 2022, while imports in 2023 have amounted to 10.8 BCM, according to the Commission's figures. Simpson said that the bloc's gas reductions had resulted in the EU's total monthly payments to Russia falling from 21.4 billion euros in March 2022 to 2.7 billion euros in March 2023. But efforts to completely end gas flows from Russia on routes where Moscow has already cut supplies foundered at the G7 summit this month after they were blocked by EU delegates. Questions also remain over whether the EU can secure any additional gas supplies this year, as most available LNG has already been contracted. One diplomat from a non-EU country said, "This is only so much supply and a lot of it is already committed. It seems to be the case that the EU is asking for more than is feasibly possible."
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The United Nations has warned that millions of people across Sudan are running out of food and are on the brink of famine as the situation in the war-torn northeast African country is spiraling out of control. The international body has said the ongoing armed conflict has impeded agricultural activities, causing millions of people to face acute food insecurity. Many people are also dying due to lack of healthcare. Time is running out for farmers to plant the crops that will feed them and their neighbors. The situation is spiraling out of control.
It's looting humanitarian supplies, targeting aid workers and hospitals, or blocking aid. Things we have seen throughout those 4 months may amount to war crimes and crimes against humanity.
According to the UN, the war has caused over 1 million people to cross from Sudan into neighboring countries, many already struggling with the impact of conflicts or economic crises. Those displaced within Sudan are estimated to number over 3.4 million people. Furthermore, more than 6 million people in Sudan are one step away from famine. More than 14 million children need humanitarian aid. The statement comes as 4 months of a power struggle between Sudan's army and the paramilitary rapid support forces has killed nearly 4,000 people. The conflict erupted on April 15th over tensions linked to a planned transition to civilian rule, plunging the country into violence. UN officials also say reports of sexual assaults have increased in the country.
Just to give you an idea, we've seen an increase of more than 900% in the conflict areas of gender-based violence. 900%. Those women are incredibly at risk, and we really do need the funding and the access to those areas to be able to provide services for them.
Reports from our protection and field teams in neighboring Chad, Central African Republic, Egypt, and South Sudan have also described the horrific ordeals faced by women and girls in Sudan. Shocking incidents of sexual violence, including rape, sexual assault, sexual exploitation, and physical violence, have been reported by women and girls who have fled the conflict.
Fighting in Sudan broke out back in April over a power struggle between two rival generals, Army Chief Abdel Fattah al-Burhan and former deputy Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo.
Once we put on these khakis, we have no other path. We do not get startled or afraid. And even if every one of us is dead, we will not be frightened or back away.
The clashes initially broke out in Khartoum and later spread to Darfur. The roots of the crisis dates to several years ago. In 2019, a coup d'etat ousted the country's longtime ruler, Omar al-Bashir, in the context of massive civil disobedience. An interim joint civilian military unity government headed by Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok was established. However, in October 2021, the military seized power in a coup which was led by the Sudanese Armed Forces leader Abdel Fattah al-Burhan and Rapid Support Forces led by Hamdan Dagalo. Rapid Support Forces evolved from so-called Janjaweed militias which fought in a conflict in the 2000s in the Darfur region. Over time, the militia grew. It was made into the RSF in 2013 and its forces were used as border guards in particular. In 2017, a law legitimizing the RSF as an independent security force was passed. There are also indications that Bashir-era loyalists in the army feared that a new political agreement would significantly harm their economic and political power. Many of these loyalists blame RSF leader Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo for turning on al-Bashir in 2019. Despite peace efforts, fighting continued unabated in the African country, with the army and the RSF trading blame over truce violations. In May, the two warring sides agreed to send negotiating teams to Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, to start talks brokered by Riyadh and Washington. At least 16 ceasefire agreements followed, with each of them collapsing.
The U.S. military has decided to send F-16 fighter planes to Ukraine from Denmark and the Netherlands as soon as the training of Ukrainian pilots is completed. A U.S. official said on Thursday Washington has assured both countries that it will expedite approval of transfer requests for F-16s to go to Ukraine when their pilots are trained. The U.S. must approve the transfer of F-16s from its allies to Ukraine. Coalition of 11 countries was due to start training Ukrainian pilots to fly fighter jets this month in Denmark.
As you know, Denmark and the Netherlands are taking the lead on training. We have, and the president has given the green light to allow and support the training to move forward, but I just don't have any further updates at this time when it comes to specific pilots being trained.
The thing is that it is a very strong weapon system. It's a very strong capability, but it's not going to be available anytime soon. President Zelensky, of course, knows that.
U.S. officials have privately said that the F-16 fighter jets would be no game changer when they arrive, given Russia's air defense systems and its air superiority, that the request would be approved. The U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken sent letters to his Danish and Dutch counterparts, assuring them that the request would be approved. He said the approval of the request would allow Ukraine to take full advantage of its new capabilities as soon as the first set of pilots complete their training.
Officials in Kiev have repeatedly requested the F-16s. Some NATO states have agreed to instruct Ukrainian pilots, but it remains unclear when the first transfer could occur. U.S. President Joe Biden endorsing training programs for Ukrainian pilots on F-16s in May, but no timing for the supply of the warplanes has been declared yet. According to a recent report in the Washington Post, the initial batch of Ukrainian pilots trained on F-16 will not be ready until after the summer of 2024, with only six airmen set to complete the first round of instructions.
Flying wise, well, technically, I mean, if you're a pilot, this is also just an airplane. But to fly a fighter jet and to transition to an F-16, which for them would mean like different technology, different design concepts.
Russia has repeatedly warned that the influx of Western weapons and military equipment only prolongs the conflict and increases the risk of military confrontation with NATO. Moscow has said Western powers would run, quote, colossal risks if they decided to supply the F-16. Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has said that Russia would consider the aircraft a nuclear threat due to its ability to carry atomic weapons.
Yes, look, that's right. I mean, the pro-war people keep saying, look, it's up to Ukraine to decide when to negotiate. But the reality is the U.S. is funding practically 100% of this war, and the allies are providing 100% of the munitions. So at any time they could say, look, you know, enough's enough. We're not going to do this anymore. And then, of course, Ukraine would have to negotiate.
Ukraine says its troops have recaptured a village from Russian forces in the southeastern Donetsk region. Ukraine's deputy defense minister said forces have secured their position by erecting defensive lines on the outskirts of the village. There was no immediate response to the Ukrainian claim from Moscow. Separately, Russian drones inflicted damage upon grain facilities at Danube port in the southern region of Odessa. Ukraine has also launched a number of cross-border drone attacks inside of Russia. Meanwhile, NATO member Poland has held its biggest military parade since the Cold War in an event that marked victory over Soviet forces in 1920. Warsaw showcased the country's state-of-the-art weaponry as the war was raging in neighboring Ukraine. Poland's army has more than 175,000 troops, an increase from approximately 100,000 8 years ago.
There are existing risks associated with the militarization of Poland, which has become the main instrument of the United States' anti-Russian policy. Warsaw announced the intention to build, according to the Poles, the most powerful army on the continent.
Poland has also expressed concern about the movement of Wagner forces in Belarus towards the Polish border. The Polish Prime Minister has said, "We have information that more than 100 Wagner mercenaries have advanced towards the Suwalki Gap, not far from Grodno in Belarus. Grodno is located in the west of Belarus, about 15 kilometers from its border with NATO members Poland and Lithuania. The Suwalki Gap is a narrow strategic land corridor on their territory between Belarus and Russia's Baltic exclave of Kaliningrad. Poland is worried about its security with Russian ally Belarus and Ukraine on its eastern border.
Anti-French sentiment runs high in Niger as thousands of people have rallied near a French military base on the outskirts of the capital, Niamey, to call for the withdrawal of the country's forces. Protesters shouted "Down with France" and "Down with ECOWAS" as they surrounded the base. The demonstrators argue that the West African regional bloc is not independent and is being manipulated by France. ECOWAS has given the green light for a military intervention in Niger after it approved the deployment of a standby force as part of its effort to remove Niger military rulers following last month's coup and reinstate deposed pro-Western leader Mohamed Bazoum. The Ivory Coast president says heads of state of the 15-nation bloc have agreed that the operation should start as soon as possible. The president said his country will provide a maximum of 1,100 troops alongside soldiers from Nigeria and Benin. He said other member countries will join them later. France has thrown its full backing to all the conclusions of the West African leaders who met in Nigerian capital Abuja to make the necessary arrangements. The United States has also voiced support for efforts of ECOWAS on Niger.
As significantly, ECOWAS, the organization that brings together West African countries, is playing a lead role in making clear the imperative of the return to constitutional order, and we very much support ECOWAS's leadership and work on this.
The support for ECOWAS efforts come as a deadline set by the regional bloc for Bazoum to be reinstated on August 6th was ignored by Nigerian junta. The junta has moved one step further and announced a new government there. The developments in Niger come nearly 3 weeks after soldiers belonging to the country's presidential guard blockaded access to President Bazoum's residence in Niamey and arrested him. Shortly after the storming of the president's residence, the army led by General Abdurrahman Tiani took control of the country's political leadership there. The idea of a military intervention in Niger comes as many people across the West African nation are opposed to foreign meddling in their internal political affairs.
Today they're in front of our army. It's no longer that they're in front of us. That's to say, if they're thinking of attacking the military, they will first have to attack us, the people of Niger.
But unlike Nigerians, Western countries, namely France and the United States, are pushing for a military intervention there. After all, there are certain facts that lie within their interest, which a change in Nigerian political leadership can hamper all those benefits. In the case of France, the country has domination over Niger's economy. That's why Paris has been seeking a military solution to the crisis in Niger since the very first day of the outbreak of the coup there. One significant factor is Niger's vast uranium reserves. The country supplies around 5% of the world's uranium and is a leading supplier of that chemical element to the European Union. The French government is almost entirely dependent on Niger, as some 25% of Niger's uranium production goes to France. Using that uranium to produce electricity, Paris has become a large exporter of power that goes to countries like Germany and other European nations. The electricity export of that amount makes French huge profits, which make it hard for Paris to admit new political changes in Niger. In the case of the United States, Washington is seeing a growing tendency toward Russia among people in West African nations, including Niger, Burkina Faso, and Mali, and that is why, seeing its political interests in tatters, it is pushing for a military intervention in Niger to reinstate pro-West former President Bazoum. With ECOWAS being under the direct influence of Western powers, an actual military intervention in Niger is not unthinkable, despite repeated warnings from Russia that any such move would destabilize the whole region. But apart from that, what matters most of all is that Niger belongs to Nigerians, and they are the ones who should decide their own fate. Given all the anti-Western hatred among the people of Niger and other West African nations, it seems that it is for the Western countries to stop meddling in the affairs of those nations and let people choose their own political path. The United Kingdom is hit with yet another strike action as junior doctors have launched a new walkout amid continued disputes with the government over pay and working conditions. The four-day strike began on Friday and continues until Tuesday. It includes actions by doctors just days into the medical practice. Doctors say their walkout has reached its tipping point due to the government's failure to deliver on its promises. The junior doctors demand a 35% rise. but the government says that is unrealistic and not negotiable. It is proposing a fourth of what junior doctors are asking for. The action is set to impact tens of millions of people receiving services from the National Health Service or NHS. The walkout could push only the number of appointments cancelled due to the NHS strikes past 1 million.
Pay us or lose us!
Save our NHS!
Save our NHS!
Rishi Sunak, hear us out!
Pay us properly or get out!
NHS officials have warned of massive disruptions as a result of the strike action taken by the junior doctors.
This latest round of junior doctors' strikes will again significantly disrupt services for patients. The additional changes this time is that organizations are unable to use agency workers to cover staff out on a strike. It is also a period of time where NHS staff often take annual leave, so there are already gaps in the workplace.
The comments by Dr. Powis comes as the number of people on waiting lists for treatment has surged to a record 7.6 million. In the past months, UK nurses, ambulance staff, and other medical workers have all joined the industrial action across the NHS, mounting more pressure on the government to address the economic woes and financial stress on the public health service workers. The four-day stoppage by junior doctors comes as the British Medical Association, or BMA, which represents strikers, says the take-home pay of junior doctors has plunged by 26% in the last 15 years. BMA says it will continue to campaign for better pays for its members after branding the public sector pay rise announced by the government in July as insufficient. UK Health Minister Steve Barclay has remained defiant to the junior doctors' request for increased pay. Barclay insists that the pay increase is sufficient and has urged the BMA to end its strikes immediately. Barclay says a pay rise of 6% announced by the government is final. This comes as Britain has been hit hard by similar such action for the past year, with NHS staff being among the main government employees calling for higher wages and better working conditions. The most recent one was a strike staged by senior doctors on July 20 and 21. The British Medical Association said senior doctors will stage another two-day walkout on August 24th and 25th, with the industrial action expected to put the country's National Health Service under more strain.
We are, as senior doctors, really concerned about the state of the NHS, and the only way we could technically make our voices heard was to strike around something that was pay and conditions. So we've had to make ourselves come to the forefront and raise our voices about the concern we have of the NHS.
The back-to-back walkouts have already taken their toll on the country's healthcare system, prompting fears for patients' safety. Not only that, the unprecedented cost of living crisis in the UK has already impacted the Brits hard. Just to mention a few examples, an umbrella group has warned that London's housing crisis is becoming unmanageable as 1 in 50 Londoners are now living in temporary accommodation. The group has urged the government to help low-income families. In the case of food prices, the cost of some basic items such as cheese, butter and bread has soared to more than 30% in the last 2 years, forcing poorer households to make desperate choices between keeping up with their bill payment or putting food on the table. But those are just the tip of the iceberg, as the government of Prime Minister Rishi Sunak is dealing with a huge economic paralysis. From raising of interest rates to curb inflation and its subsequent impact on the UK households, to a large portion of the British population being at a breaking point in dealing with their economic situation, it is not clear what lies ahead in the future for the Brits. Maybe a change in government economic policies can act as a short-term remedy to bring an end to the crisis in the UK.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Deadly wildfires in Hawaii, which caused the biggest death toll in more than a century in the U.S. and forced thousands to evacuate from their homes, exposed the incompetence of the U.S. government. Experts say, with many local residents who survived the disaster posting videos on social media, criticizing the problematic response of local authorities and poor early warning system. Residents also criticize U.S. mainstream media reports saying this was not just a natural disaster, but also a man-made calamity. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Global Times noted, analysts and web users are paying attention to the horrible tragedy that Americans have suffered, as the hashtags on Sina Weibo about Hawaii wildfires have received more than 71.52 million views. Experts said the response of the U.S. government made the U.S. look unlike a developed country. A massive blaze destroyed much of the town of Lahaina on Maui over the weekend. Recently, officials confirmed 99 people have died. Hawaii Governor Josh Green told the media that the death toll would likely increase very significantly and could double or even triple over the next 10 days, according to CNN. Green said that there was very little left of Lahaina and some 1,300 people remained missing, according to CBS News. Many people, including survivors, uploaded videos to break the silence on social media networks to heavily criticize the incompetence of the government and the problematic response and early warning system. Some questioned reports by the mainstream media and said it was not a natural disaster and death toll could be far greater than reported. Some of them said warning sirens did not sound and people received no warning about the wildfire and they were not informed about evacuation. Some complained about the disorganized response and poor traffic system that trapped the people who wanted to escape and the rescue personnel who wanted to enter the island, and that donations have not been handed to the people in need. Some relief materials were looted as local authorities failed to restore public order. Hawaii has got a massive outdoor public safety early warning system with more than 400 sirens to remind people of threats like tsunamis, and Mo'oi has 80 of these sirens, according to the Xinhua news agency. In 2018, the system mistakenly informed the people of Hawaii state that a ballistic missile is coming due to human error. And in 2019, the system went wrong again and caused panic among locals. But this time, it failed to warn people effectively, and the state attorney has vowed to investigate, Xinhua reported recently.
The Washington Post also reported residents of Lahaina, the historic former Hawaiian capital that became an inferno, have criticized what they called inadequate warnings of the sudden firestorm and said they are now being left to fend for themselves in its wake. Kai Linney, a professional surfer, according to Washington Post, said, "I feel like the citizens of this island have been called upon, maybe by a higher power, to actually help because no one else is helping." Many Chinese netizens do not understand why the powerful U.S. military force can allow Americans to feel helpless during the disaster when the Pacific Fleet is right there in Hawaii. A comment said, "Why don't U.S. military troops go to rescue their people in the disaster area?" In China, the military, police, and other professional rescue forces will respond immediately to rescue people every time when disaster occur in any location in China. Lu Xiang, an expert on U.S. studies and a research fellow at the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences, told the Global Times that the response of the U.S. military or National Guards this time has no comparison to their fast reaction after the Capitol Hill attack in 2021, and this means the decision makers of the country did not pay enough attention to this disaster that caused huge casualties. Lu said, "From the early warning system to the response after the disaster, the performance of the U.S. government this time just makes the U.S. look unlike a developed country." U.S. President Joe Biden was in Rebo Beach, Delaware, over the weekend and was asked during a bike ride whether he would go to Maui to assess the devastation. He replied, "We are looking at it." After a visit to the beach later that day, Biden was asked about the rising death toll on the island and replied, "No comment," according to U.S. media. The comment sparked a backlash, Fox News reported, including by former Hawaii State Representative Mark Kaniela Ng, a Democrat who now serves as National Director of the Green New Deal Network. "I campaigned for you. Now, when I lose dozens of my friends, family, and neighbors, this?" Kaniela Ng wrote in a now-deleted post. Kaniela Ng told Fox News Digital in a phone interview recently that he found Biden's remark shocking and out of character. This kind of disaster is closely related to climate change, but the Biden administration shows limited sincerity in restoring international cooperation to handle climate change issues, analysts say, adding that a disaster like the Hawaii wildfires has not received enough attention from the mainstream U.S. media, and people from other states do not seem to care much what is happening in Hawaii. Lu said, "When I open the websites or apps of U.S. mainstream media like the New York Times and CNN, the headline story today is about former President Donald Trump's legal issues. And other prominent news stories are about Ukraine. But the reports about the most deadly wildfire in more than a century in the United States, while the death toll is keep updating, can only be found at the bottom." Guardian also noted, as Hawaii continues to grapple with the aftermath of the disaster, frustration at the government response to the deadliest wildfire in recent U.S. history is mounting. Residents have raised questions over officials' approach, from warnings during the inferno to aid distribution in the days since, and have argued that residents aren't getting the help they need. Jacqueline Ingram with the Healthy Mothers, Healthy Babies Coalition of Hawaii, which has been providing care and supplies to residents, said, "I think people will continue to be upset. It's a slow response. The needs are enormous. More than 2,700 structures in Lahaina have been destroyed.
The Hawaii governor, Josh Green, said recently, with losses mounting to an estimated $5.6 billion. The Federal Emergency Management Agency is overseeing the federal response and has 416 people on the ground.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, on June 11, 2023, in a meeting with a number of scientists, specialists, experts, and officials of Iran's nuclear industry. The existing scientists and experts should be used as much as possible. Their protection should be taken seriously. Anyway, respecting human resources and maintaining human resources is very important in this industry. Of course, the organization's performance in recruiting human resources and managing these resources is also important. How to manage human resources in terms of various evaluations in different aspects is also important. After all, the enemy is working in these areas, and you have seen this, and friends have tasted the enemy's blows. The enemies infiltrate places and commit acts of sabotage, which they have done, and we have all seen this. You must be very serious in taking care. Human resources are very valuable. Protect them. In evaluating them, use maximum consideration, skill, and accuracy.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
There is also a recommendation about some of the challenges faced by the organization. For instance, communication with the IAEA. I strongly recommend you maintain communications with the agency. That is, maintain cooperation and interaction with the International Atomic Energy Agency, but of course, within the framework of safeguards agreements. That is, do not accept to do more than that and only do what we need to do according to the safeguards agreements. From the beginning, my recommendation to these various officials who have come and gone in this industry over the past 20 years has always been the same. I have said that you must work with the IAEA. At the same time, Parliament's laws must not be violated. This is my next recommendation. Parliament has passed a law, the Strategic Action Plan to Counter Sanctions. This law is in our interest. It is in the interest of the countries and in the interest of the nuclear industry. Some people imagine that this law is creating problems for the country. They are wrong. This law is a good law. In any case, it is a law, and the law must be obeyed. There is no room for discussion. The law must not be violated. Whether it is in gaining the access expected from you or in the information you provide, act according to this law.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Religious leaders from more than 200 different spiritualities and 80 different countries gathered in Chicago for the Parliament of the World's Religions, the largest interfaith conference in the world. Since 1893, the organization has brought together people of faith who are committed to justice, peace, and spiritual growth. A key conference was Faith Over Fear, Countering Anti-Muslim Discrimination, which aimed to connect, equip, and energize all people of faith for anti-racist mobilizations or in anticipation of a looming Islamophobic incident.
In the United States, which is where our focus is, it is, in some cases, it comes in waves, but as we're now facing another presidential campaign cycle, we're keeping our eyes and ears open because we expect that anti-Muslim hatred will become part of the conversation in the public square, perhaps even in some of the political campaigns themselves.
In Sweden and Denmark recently, the Holy Quran was burned and defaced in appalling and unnecessary provocations, and with their governments refusing to intervene, sparking protests worldwide. Activists noted that if someone hates Muslims, they likely hate many others as well.
Not only do studies show that people that hold anti-Muslim views also hold anti-Semitic views, also views about immigrants and refugees, black and brown communities, and so we believe that in addressing anti-Muslim discrimination and violence, we're making an inroads to help people address other forms of discrimination and racism, especially within